רגע, לפני שמתחילים, אם אתם יכולים, בבקשה, דרגו אותנו באפליקציית הפודקאסטים שלכם. זה מאוד מאוד יעזור לנו להפיץ את הבשורה של הערוץ ליותר אנשים. ממש תודה רבה לכם. פתיח ומתחילים.
הפודקאסט של דוקטור רועי יוזביץ'.
Can anyone excel in math and science? And are we just missing some learning tricks? And if so, why no one teaches us those tricks? Hi, and welcome to my channel. My name is Roy Yosevich, and in this channel, I host and speak with the most interesting and influential people from all around the world to discuss science, theology, learning, productivity, creativity, and artificial intelligence. And if this is your first time in this channel, please consider subscribing, hit the bell button, and move on. And my guest today is Professor Barbara Oakley. Professor Barbara Oakley is most recently a distinguished professor at some university in the United States, I forgot. But much more importantly, she is the author of Mindful Number, and with Terry Sinofsky, she have the most viewed online course, MOOC, in the history of online learning, Learning How to Learn. And in this channel, I have had many very important and very brilliant people from all around the world. But I think that Barbara has changed my life the most, because ever since watching her online course, it completely flipped everything that I knew about studies, about learning, and many of the things that I'm doing today are strongly related to the techniques that she taught me 5 years ago. So, Bob, thank you so much for coming. It's a true honor to speak with you today.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here. And now after this buildup, I'm like, oh my goodness, what can I possibly say that's going to sound innovative? Because I'm a pretty normal person. So, you know, I think that if anything, what I give is how to learn effectively if you're just a normal person. So, but you're not a normal person. So, you know, so clearly it works for many more.
Okay. Thank you so much. It's like in my YouTube channel, I have over 10,000 people, and many people come approach me and say, wow, I'm very excited to speak with you. And I feel exactly the same today. Now, I was wondering, would like you to tell your story, or I don't want to waste like such a precious time with you, but I think that nevertheless your story is so inspirational and so important, because in your high school, in your youth, in your childhood, you didn't think, you were convinced that you are suck at math. And this is like and you're like a professor of engineering nowadays and ever since 1988. But what changed your perspective? Because we know that you went to the army and learned Russian, and you have a Bachelor of Art in Slovakian language. But what was the pinpoint, the one thing that made you think, hey, maybe I can also learn math, chemistry, engineering, etc.?
Well, I didn't know for sure that I could learn these things. But what motivated me was that I couldn't get, there were no job opportunities opening up for me that had the kind of work that I was interested in, you know, that could do something that really sort of lifted my spirits and got me excited. And I was 26 years old. I was going to get out of the army. I had followed my passion and learned Russian really well. And nobody ever bothered to tell me that following your passion is just not enough, that it can put you into sort of a career box. And if your passion is very limited, it can really put you in a small career box. You know, there was nobody out there looking for to hire, or very few people that were looking to hire experts in Slavic languages and literature. But I, you know, so I was really motivated to try to get a job in an area that I could see was going to be opening up in the future. And that involved technology and it involved engineering. And so I thought, well, you know, I always kind of prided myself on being adventurous and looking at the world through new perspectives. And then I realized, you know, what could be more alien to my entire personality than engineering? You know, I was like the typical proverbial language person, and I couldn't do math. You know, it was just like, I just wasn't a math person. And I just thought, well, if I'm supposed to be adventurous, then this is a really terrific undertaking for me to just see if I could try to do it. And I remember those first, like that first couple of semesters, especially the very first one, going, oh my word, you know, what if I can't do it? And what I did was I gave myself like extra time. I didn't take a bunch of courses. I just took a few courses in, remedial high school algebra to get started, and then basic chemistry and so forth. And slowly I worked my way into it. And as first I, you know, I would like work at my studies for 6 months, and then I couldn't take it anymore. So I'd go out and work out on Soviet trawlers as a Russian translator. So I'd go
because
out
because your father told you to.
Because my
did my homework, Bob. I actually did my homework.
You really did, because they called me, that company. I had applied for them, and they called me and said, we've got a job for you. And I said, nah, I'm just starting to get into chemistry, and I should take chemistry this summer. And then my father overheard that that's, you know, that I was giving up this job opportunity. And that was the one time in his life where he was like, are you kidding me? You know, because normally it was like, whatever you want to do, you want to join the army, you'll learn a lot, you know, whatever. But anyway, I slowly began climbing my way upwards in learning math and science. And the higher I went, the better I got. And that's because as you gain a framework, a neural framework in learning anything, if you learn it well, it will make the new learning come more easily. And so to my shock today, I am now a distinguished professor of engineering. Who knew?
Wealth attracts wealth, and knowledge attracts knowledge. So I wanted to ask you, because you said about follow your passion being a bad advice. Now, I had the same thing with Mike Wall, which is like the producer and of Dirty Jobs, and Cal Newport in Deep Work, which basically says that when you focus on follow your passion, you basically focus on yourself. You are the center point, and you need to focus on the other people. What industry, what society wants for me, what set of abilities should I possess in order to be effective towards something in the industry. So if you could please elaborate on this, because all this millennial thing, many people just follow your dream. And it's not just bad advice, because many people want to be on American Got Talent, which is like a fraction of the people. But it's also bad advice, even if you want to be a marine biologist, as in Seinfeld, because when you consider what you need to do or what job you want to pursue, you also need to think about what are the possible income opportunities. So if you could please elaborate on this, because I think it's extremely important.
I couldn't agree more. I think that part of the challenge, you know, it just shocks me how people can have real cognitive dissonance about their approach to working in the world. I mean, they'll be like, we need to help others. We need to be thinking about others. We need to be, supporting you know, agencies that are not for profit and really being helpful for other people. But when it comes to selecting your own job, it's like, okay, now you're supposed to be totally selfish. It's just follow your own passion. Don't think about what the world needs. I mean, that's just so, it doesn't compute. It's either one or the other. You know, it has to be a little bit of both. You want to be sort of oriented towards what you like and what you don't like. But the reality is, whether you like it or not, you know, a lot of people get out into the working world. They can have, if they're not careful with what they study, they can end up, you know, doing social work, which may help others, but they don't even realize that the amount of debt that they acquire to get that specialization is virtually never going to be paid off during their lifetime. Is that really what they intended? And a lot of times, I mean, if you ask people who specialized in that afterwards, they say, we just didn't think it through. So it's really important to approach your job, you know, your vision for your future with a little bit of, you know, nitty gritty, you know, willing to face honest facts. Do you want to be in debt for, you know, for most of the years of your adult life? Or would you rather have money? And the thing that I think a lot of people don't realize is that if you get, let's say you get a degree in electrical engineering, people will say, ah, it put me in this box. I was working in a cubicle, or, you know, I'm going to be working in a cubicle and so forth. But you get a degree in electrical engineering, what that really does is simply prove that you're really smart and you don't have to work as an electrical engineer. It actually opens so many job opportunities for you. So, you know, putting in a little bit of pain, it's super easy to get some degrees. I mean, people will argue with you, but sometimes I joke that, you know, if you run into a bad professor or a couple professors in engineering, they can chase you out of the discipline. And in some sense, psychology can be considered the crystal meth of bad engineering professors. You know, it's like when life gets bad for, you know, studying engineering, you take the easy way out. And it can be disciplines that often simply, you know, don't pay as well. And it's because many, many, many more people are able to do those disciplines. And so it just makes it that way. So, I mean, I love psychology. I'm fascinated by it. I'm also very much aware that if I were to get to have gotten a degree in that, it would not nearly have opened the doors that having a degree in engineering and then looking at psychology. In fact, I'm able to look at psychology with a much better perspective on that now with my background in engineering. I can see the gaping holes in the discipline that psychology majors simply can't see. It's trained out of them. So if you're
really by the way, many mathematicians will say that they see the gaps where you and me as engineers, we cannot see. So many mathematicians, although earning much less money, we will say you lack this toolbox that we possess, and therefore you need us. And in some part, this is absolutely true, because we as engineers, our math capabilities are very limited compared to mathematicians. So it goes just as engineering and psychology, it will go engineering, physics, math.
Yeah, that's such a great point. And I think sort of a corollary to that point is whatever field you are trained in, it can be that outsider perspectives on that field can be extremely beneficial. And so Thomas Kuhn, in his book, Structures of Scientific Revolution, found that there were two major types or groups of people who could think in truly paradigm shifting ways. One was young people who hadn't yet been sort of indoctrinated into the disciplinary way of thinking, but the other group was people who had originally been trained in other disciplines. And they're able to look with fresh eyes at whatever that discipline is. So, you know, whether you're a physicist looking at economics, a mathematician looking at engineering, there's so many ways that
you can... Or psychologists looking at economics, like Daniel Kahneman, or the examples that you provided, a physicist tried to go into the field of neuroscience. And if he does the training phase correctly, he will be a master, bring his own fresh perspective.
That's exactly right. And I think you bring fresh perspectives by your very different background. And that's what people love about your work.
Thank you so much. Because I've written 4 psychology books, basically, but we dismissed all the humanities in our channel. Now, most of the books in my libraries are humanities. I adore psychology, I adore philosophy, I adore everything. But there is something about the objective metrics in the science that you cannot achieve from the humanities. Something that is, you know... paraphrasing Hamlet, something is rotten in the kingdom of humanities. And we don't see this rotten thing in the kingdom of science yet because of the objective metrics. The objective metrics that something can be either true or false, correct or incorrect, true or wrong. And this is something that we don't see in psychology, but we more and more see in neuroscience, where neuroscience is like, you know, the next step towards an objective psychology, which is why I'm very fascinated about neuroscience. Okay, I want a straight, clear answer. But with your permission, let me give another perspective of what you said, because you said that you are even thinking about yourself or thinking about others. And if I can quote the late Ken Robinson, the element is a place where your talent and your passion meet. So this is exactly the thing. If you're going to a walk when you have passion, but you don't have talent or skill, it won't work. So if you want to take care of yourself, if you want to maximize, if the target function is to maximize your fun, you should also consider what things you are good at and not only the things that you like. Because the element is where your talent and your passion meet. So this is another perspective. You always need to think or rethink about how can you utilize your skills. What do you think?
Well, I'm always suspicious of anything that Ken Robinson says. And indeed, if you looked at me, I was like totally not good at mathematics. I mean, just terrible at it. And I had no technical skills. So I should obviously never have become an engineer, you know, by that light. I think that a lot of times passions develop about what you're good at. So if you're willing to put some time in while you're still not good at something, you can start to become good at things, and then that can start to develop a talent. Now, will I be comparable to some of my engineering professor friends who can, you know, analyze a circuit at the drop of a hat? No, but on the other hand, I can use my engineering skills to do handsprings with things that they cannot. So, you know, I'm really glad that I studied engineering, and I'm no engineering genius, but I can do things with engineering that standard engineers cannot. And I'm really glad I studied the discipline.
I saved this question for later on because I have carefully viewed your scholar profile. And it seems that, yes, so and basically ever since 88. And I have a theory that, you know, reading all your articles and your most quoted articles are not about engineering, are about education and the learning and how to cheat, how to teach, and the online learning. And in some aspects, it seems that being an engineering professor is just like the credentials, the mandatory credentials that you need in order to say, listen, those techniques actually work. Okay? So if your most important work, according to Google Scholar, is not in the field of system engineering, but in the field of online learning, education, and so on. Would you agree?
Yes, I would. But I would also say that I feel much more comfortable in the technology of creating massive open online courses than the vast majority of academicians because I'm trained as an engineer. So I can kind of go back and forth and, does Yale have a large course in the humanities? Well, that professor, who teaches the course is augmented by an enormous team at Yale. And, for Terry and I, it was just kind of us and my hubby helped some. The engineering training, it may seem like, it was just a credential and it wasn't important, but it was immensely important in my ability to, part of it is when you're teaching about learning, if you're a psychologist teaching about learning, people like a programmer is going to sit there and say, yeah, right. Yeah, but what do you really know from an advanced technical perspective about my, about programming, about engineering or any of those
about things? Calculus. You can't teach me how to learn calculus because you never took calculus as a prerequisite course or linear algebra.
Exactly right. And so when I'm teaching about about how to learn effectively, people can see that I've walked the walk, that I actually know what I'm talking about when I'm talking about taking a derivative or, I can actually spell eigenvalue, unlike Malcolm Gladwell. it makes a big difference because the way I teach about learning draws on my own background learning at very high levels in STEM disciplines.
This is very interesting because people usually go only one way and not the other way around. They usually don't say, okay, you are expert in math and science. How can you teach me about learning, learning psychology or the humanities? They only go from the humanities to math. They say, okay, you are expert in psychology. What do you know about math? But if you're expert in math, they will assume that yes, if this helped for math, it will definitely help for the humanities. And I don't know if this statement is actually true. Do we need like different techniques and different tools for the science and humanities? Or basically, if you look at the science of learning, yes, chunking, retrieval practice, recall, interleaving, all the other things, they are basically the same for math and for the humanities.
Well, the thing is that if you look up till about, maybe 5-8 years ago, a psychologist would say things like, it's really not important to remember anything at all because you can always look it up. And that just doesn't work in learning in math and science. And it really doesn't work in learning language and a lot of other things. But psychologists, and we're talking, people with PhDs from top universities, they would all go about mouthing this off. And I remember attending a workshop that I finally just, I waited until a break so that I wouldn't stalk off and discuss during the time that he was teaching the workshop. But he was saying, well, you know, you you don't need to memorize anything. You can always look up things. And I finally raised my hand and just said, you know, there's profound evidence that that's not true. And then there were a couple of other engineers in the audience that said, you know, that's the same thing for me. I found that if I memorized some equations, it really helped and so forth. So anyway, I think psychology, and clearly there's some great researchers in cognitive psychology, Jeff Karpicki, Pooja Agarwal, and others, you know, with retrieval practice, with deliberate practice, with
the Bjork, the Bjork Club.
Bob Bjork is awesome. And they're doing some great things. And it's starting to come into the fore now. But I for a long time, psychology has, in my opinion, had counterproductive effects when it comes to education and
learning. Which leads me to the next question, which I'm pondering about for like the last 5 years. If you look, or if someone will ever write a book about the history of online learning, he will mention Coursera, edX, Udacity, Udemy, Sal Khan, etc. And all those people, Daphne Koller, Adwin Nigg, Sebastian Thurn, Anat Agrawal, you, Sal Khan from Khan Academy, the guys from Udemy, all of them were trained in the science, in the STEM disciplines. None of them was trained in the humanities. None of them was trained in psychology and education. So the biggest leap or the biggest progress that humanity has ever known as like the online course, the online massive open online courses, was brought to us solely by people from the STEM. And the people from education and psychology contributed nothing. And my question is it just a chance that all the good achievements, Coursera, edX, Udacity, Khan Academy, Lynda, all the things that you can think about, MIT OpenCourseWare, came from the science? Because this is a big question, okay? Why education and psychology didn't bring us this new achievement?
You know, education is not solely online, although I love to think that, you know, the future of education will be heavily invested in online. So online is by its very nature, very technical. You know, developing new platforms is a very technical thing. On the other hand, who is the president now of Coursera? An English major who's really able to bring in some great perspectives and new ideas. So I think that it's, you know, it's not a fluke. It's that, you know, that we have all these sort of STEM-oriented people who are involved in online education. It's simply a factor that, you know, the development of many of these platforms and so forth, you know, it demands a technical background. But for me in particular, I sure could not have done what I do without my background in the humanities. I mean, that allows me to much more easily bring in metaphor and, you know, just sort of...
The zombies, the famous zombies, zombies.
Yeah, and octopuses.
The pinball. This was very harsh for me because we usually don't play so much pinball in Israel. So I needed to go with other examples as well.
And there's ways to do it. So, you know, I think we shouldn't discount the value that humanities can bring. But I do like to think that it would be beneficial for those in the humanities. We're always saying that STEM students need to study the humanities. But when it comes to humanities students, we're like, you know, well, you can take, you know, mathematics as poetry, you know, or something like that, that doesn't teach any math at all. And I do think that those in the humanities could you know, benefit from a little bit more solid and in depth.
And you can't do anything important in philosophy today without learning a little bit about science, neuroscience, and modern physics. Okay. Mm-hmm. And this is very important. If there is such a gap between philosophy, yes, and conscientiousness, conscious, and free will, and you don't know anything about neuroscience, so your work is like, you know, just a coffee shop chat. Now, which leads me to something that you said, I think, 4 or 5 years ago at a Google Talk. And you said something that for me was very insightful. And you said, we try as educators to make math as fun as possible and to make coding as fun as possible. And we have like Code Monkey, if you know what it is, like many, and we have like Scratch, and we have many, many platforms that makes codes or coding very fun, and we make math fun. But math is inherently not fun in certain stages. And when we say to the young kinders or to middle school guys, this is math, and the first time they approach math in its real form in the university, they will give up. And we need not to make math more beautiful than what it is. We don't need like sprinkles and flares. We need to say, listen, this is math, this is challenging, this is hard, but it's worth your time. So A, did I understand you correctly? And B, could you please elaborate on making math too much fun?
Well, I think you characterized everything that I said perfectly. Probably, I think you said it better than I did. But it's a little bit like learning to ride a bicycle. When you're first learning to ride a bicycle, you fall down, you get, you know, bumps and scratches and bruises, and hopefully that's all you get. So it's not necessarily fun at all when you're learning to ride a bicycle. But once you get past those initial stages, it gets pretty cool. So it's kind of like, I mean, when people are learning a musical instrument, they know that they've got to just practice. There's times when you just have to practice, and it's not all super fun. It's not all playing air guitar. And so, you know, when we try to turn learning of math or of a language into air guitar, where it's just all fun stuff, but it's fluffy nothing burger, students, they don't really learn it. And then they begin to feel it later on that they haven't really learned it. And then they start disliking that subject because, I mean, it amazes me sometimes that we will have students, you know, from the US and in my classes, and they feel super uncomfortable with anything mathematical. And you can tell that it's how they've been brought up. It's the mathematics, the way they've learned mathematics, which in my mind, I think there's pretty good evidence that it can actually cripple students' abilities to learn in math because they often de-emphasize. I mean, I did this op-ed in the New York Times about the importance of practice to learning math. You would have thought that I had just suggested burning down all elementary schools in the US. I mean, the reaction was, oh, how dare you suggest they need more practice? This is what kills their desire to learn in math. And it's like completely the opposite. You have to go through this kind of tougher time of practice. And that's when you come out at the end, you've got these nice neural structures that you can hang new ideas on, and learning starts to become more and more fun.
Let's dig in. So make it more concrete. Do you think a sixth grade a child need to learn by heart the multiplication table? Do you think that a middle school or a high school, no matter what kinds of stage in math, need to learn how to do basic derivatives? What do you need, or what do you think we need to put into the syllabus of math in schools?
So that's a great question. I absolutely think that there's overwhelming neuroscientific evidence that learning the multiplication tables by heart so that you can quickly and easily access that information helps serve as a wonderful neural underpinning for your ability to be successful in learning fractions, in doing algebra, and of course, then that will also lead to greater opportunities for success when you're learning calculus.
And Arthur Benjamin, the mathematician, will tell you that if you know the multiplication table by heart, it will serve you well when you multiply other figures or other digits as well, because there are many, many cool rapid math tricks.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And one thing that gets me is sometimes educators who I otherwise greatly admire will say that a transfer of abilities or, you know, learning in one area is just not transferable to learning in another area, that transfer does not take place. But when it comes to, they like conveniently leave math out of the picture when they're talking about that, because math is by its very nature so abstract that it's really transferable in its skills. That's why if you learn physics, the math of physics, you can learn the math of, you know, Wall Street and become a quant or whatever. So, so there's that.
Okay, so, but... what about probability? Because I think that, again, it was Arthur Benjamin, and he is truly a great guy. And I think it was Arthur Benjamin who said, we need to learn or to teach more probability, more statistics, okay? Because those things are the subject or disciplines that we tackle, that we meet, that we encounter on a daily basis. And many people don't know what probability is and how does it relate to their lives. And we rarely learn it in this notion, not Bayesian theory, nothing.
See, I guess for me, I get a little bit, I find this to be a bit of a conundrum that I find it difficult to answer as well. If you look at the Chinese and how the Chinese learn math, you know, they're already learning calculus and they've by high school, early high school sometimes. And they find the US systems to learning math to be a joke. If we were to use more of a Chinese approach, and I'm not saying that you also dump in the other kinds of indoctrination, rigidity that come along with it, as in, you know, there's a feeling in China that teachers are gods in some sense, and you know, you never question your teacher and so forth. And I think that's part of the problem with, to my mind, with some Asian systems of learning. But if we were to have a very good math system that used much more approaches from neuroscience, we would have time to also add in probability and statistics in the higher levels of high school. So, you know, that I can see the case. I just hate to throw calculus out because I do think the calculus is important. But I also really love and appreciate probability theory. So that's a tough question. It's like Sophie's Choice.
Okay, so if this was a tough question, let me give you even a harder and inflammatory question. And if you don't want to answer, I will totally understand. I started writing a book about artificial intelligence, and then I thought maybe we need to like devote one chapter to human intelligence, because after all, artificial intelligence strives to imitate human intelligence, and this chapter became a whole book.
Yes.
Over 400 pages of human intelligence. And part, since you mentioned the Asian education system, part of what they do in Singapore is that they give you a test on when you are like 6 or 7, and this test separate different kids to different schools. Like there are like the professional schools and the more academic schools. And what we, and those tests are basically IQ or intelligent tests. And my question is, because if I read your book, How to Excel at Math and Science, even if you flunk algebra, one thing that is not mentioned in this great book is the thing of human differences in cognitive abilities. And some people cannot learn math or cannot learn algebra. I know for myself that that I'm not good at university math. Okay, I know I can see people, and because I see people in the academia all the time, which are much brighter than me. And I know that if I would have gone to like a major in math, it wouldn't go, because I'm not smart enough to do math in the university level. And I cannot contribute anything. I can contribute in many other disciplines, but I cannot contribute in math. And my question is, what about human differences or in cognitive abilities? How do you approach this very, very important yet inflammatory subject?
Oh, that's such a great question. And it's so funny because I am just wrapping up the scripts of two videos on neurodiversity and how people really learn differently. Just to very quickly give a sense, there's two different main learning superhighways in the brain by which you can deposit your sets of neural links in long-term memory, your memories. One is the declarative system through the hippocampus. The other is the procedural learning pathway through the basal ganglia. Each type of sets of neural links actually gives different capacities. So you can learn a vocabulary list, for example, through the hippocampal system for a foreign language, but you can't use it very quickly. Only if you learn it through that procedural pathway can you speak the language quickly and fluently? But so one way to categorize many learning differences is by differences in their procedural or their declarative learning systems. So for example, those with dyslexia can have severe challenges with learning through the procedural system. The same with dyspraxia and other sort of related kinds of things. So a little bit of that, and they can still learn okay, but the more you go along those lines, the harder it becomes to learn. So let's take Steven Spielberg, for example. He has dyslexia. When he's reading movie scripts, it takes him twice as long to read a movie script as it does other people. But this doesn't mean he doesn't read movie scripts. It just means when he does read it, his condition makes it harder, but at the same time, it makes him pay more attention to what's going on. There's clear evidence that autism, for example, or the autism spectrum can enhance procedural learning and perhaps minimize your ability to learn through the declarative system. So the thing is, we can't put all learners in a box, but at the same time, if we treat everyone as completely individual in their learning, which is the true way it actually is, it would become so complicated to try to teach that we couldn't really teach very well. So we generally teach to the sort of the midpoint, people who are able to learn through both systems pretty well. But I think it's really important to realize that some people really will struggle with, procedural type learning. And they might struggle with ideas like, struggle with even learning the multiplication tables, because that procedural system helps with that type of learning, but they can still learn math in a different way.
I think that it's like Immanuel Kant saying that schools is for the mediocre, because the bright will succeed even without school and the weak won't succeed even with school. But I think that you you don't treat the pinpoint hard subject that some people, no matter how hard they work, will never be able to acquire, to understand certain ideas. Would you agree that this statement is true for some people?
I think that statement is absolutely true. But there can be, sometimes it's exactly as you say, but sometimes there's surprises as well. So for example, a person with dyslexia, they can't even read the words on a page, but they can look at images and see patterns there that nobody else can see.
With your permission, I think that although the Steven Spielberg example is correct, it's like, it's a bad example since it's a romantic example, okay? And the US Army doesn't recruit anyone with IQ of below of 85 because after 100 years of research, it came to the conclusion that no matter what the training process will be, I cannot train anyone with IQ of 85 and below to be beneficial for the US Army. And the US Army has, as you know, many, many, many different jobs. Not all the people in the US Army are Navy SEALs, and not all the people in the US Army are intelligence. And although this, after 100 years of research, they cannot train anyone with IQ of below of 85. And usually when we say and we think about education and learning and online learning and Coursera and edX and all the great guys, Andrew Ng is a genius, Daphne Koller is a genius, Anat Agrawal is a genius, Sebastian, wow, all the great guys. And it seems like they don't understand that not all population are like them.
Well, that's true. And a lot of the top Coursera, the Coursera universities are by their very nature the best universities in the world. And so they often teach kind of expecting their students to be amongst the best students in the world, just like they get at Harvard, Yale, or whatever. But I'd like to flip this around. Yes.
Be my guest.
What we've focused on through most of this discussion is people with average or above IQs. We absolutely, if you have a low IQ, it makes learning more difficult in every sense. But at the same time, I know of a group of disabled students with IQs of 70 and below who were, they were just institutionalized, and then they were taught some techniques about how to learn effectively. And do you know that these students even began attending college? Now, were they superstars?
No, I didn't know it. And it is very surprising because on this podcast, I have spoken with the most prestigious IQ researchers in the world. And I think I'm very... I know the literature, even the modern literature, and this is very surprising fact. If someone with an IQ of 70 can attend college, this is a very, very surprising fact.
What they were doing was taking introductory elementary courses, but they were told that they could never take anything. And they never even thought of themselves as having any ability to learn. But once they learned through a very long training program of learning what is the Pomodoro technique, what is focused and diffuse, they need to give themselves time. They can learn these things. And then once they have these learning tools, they are actually able to use them. Are they learning more slowly and not as well, perhaps, as others with an average or above IQ? Absolutely. But it's not like they can't learn at all. Are there going to be people who have a very substantive brain damage that is going to make it so they can't learn? Yes, obviously that's going to be the case. But people can be surprisingly resilient and able to learn things. And I think one thing we have to be careful of as teachers is we can look at some kid and say, that's the village idiot sitting back there. when in fact that can be a student who's got some real extraordinary talents. And there's lots and lots of stories of exactly that kind of thing. Even Nobel Prize winners who were, you know, stigmatized and anathemized as being, you know, too stupid to learn.
Yes, so. But it's like Malcolm Gladwell, David and Goliath, when he said like he had like elite institute cognitive disorder. And he says basically, sometimes it is better for you to be a big fish in a small pond, and being like the best student in, and not the worst student in MIT. If you are a worst student in an Ivy League university, you will be much behind the best student in Brown University, for example. So there is something about the psychology that of being the worst, being last, that basically paralyze you, make you handicap. And if your cognitive abilities are not suited for Ivy League universities, so going into those Ivy League university will be a bad policy for you, because the mentality, the psychology of you will be, I'm the last. And this is what Gladwell says in David and Goliath. So sometimes the Ivy League universities, the elite institute, yes, Google, Facebook, sometimes works against you and not go works with you. So with your permission, I want to move on to two modes of thinking, focused, diffused mode. I have never seen this theory anywhere elsewhere, just in your course, in your book. And you say, listen, we have like 30, over 30 modes of thinking, and you quote and you reference all the things that you said, but how did you come up with this theory of focused and diffused mode? Because I have never seen this theory up until I read your book and watched your course.
Well, I guess I've done a lot of reading in neuroscience and cognitive psychology. And there's just, to me, there's an amazing amount of material that's out there that nobody writes about how it can be applied. For example, these differences between the declarative and the procedural learning pathways. I mean, nobody's really brought that into and applied it in education, and yet it's profoundly important in education. I've been lucky enough to work with neuroscientist Tern Sinowski, who's the Francis Crick Professor at the Salk Institute, and he's one of only 12 living human beings who's simultaneously a member of all three U.S. National Academies of Medicine, Engineering, and Sciences. So when I would have questions about these things, I could ask Terry. It's like, you just go to the pinnacle. He's one of the best neuroscientists around, and he could answer questions. So I asked about these kinds of issues, and it's been really enormously helpful working with him. But it just amazes me sometimes that there's, you know, there's a lot of pearls.
But you, Bob, you articulated it. If I ask the average person, well, you know this focused, diffused mode of thinking, he will say, yes, it's the Oakley thing with the zombies. So it's like almost your theory right now. And every person that I encounter and say, are you familiar with the focused, diffused mode of thinking? Yes, it's from learning how to learn. So it's like you brought it to the public. You made it famous.
Well, Terry and I made it famous, you know, with learning how to learn. And that's the thing is, before we even started, I was about to launch into a minor rant about the idea that there just aren't enough people who are translating the great research that's being done and like putting it in terms that people can understand and use. And so if there's one gift that I have, it's in taking fantastic insights from research and sharing it with the public in a way that they can really understand what's going on.
Now, many people, when after learning your course, after reading my books, say, but gosh, why didn't they teach me this in high school? how come I, the first time I encountered those things was during my PhD for me, and you probably heard it so many times, that why, how come I didn't know those so basic things? And many people who read my book say, I wish I would have written them like 20 years ago. So why they don't just teach us those tools? And the teachers that I've spoken with just don't know these tools. But why?
It's because we've really only been able to look into the brain over the last 20 years. And we've really begun to understand how it applies to us in everyday life over the last maybe 10, 15 years. And there's a lot of institutional inertia. I mean, everybody is full up with classes that they need to teach in, you know, elementary, middle, and high school. The last thing they want is some other coursework jammed down them. And so it's really because we haven't known these things until relatively recently. I remember when I was studying engineering, I was like, I'm gonna look at this page until I really understand it. And I looked and looked and I reread that page like a dozen times. And finally, accidentally, I turned the page and lo and behold, it all fell into place only when I turned the page. And I remember thinking that, you know, why doesn't somebody like have some kind of information about how to learn more effectively? And it's back in that those days, you know, the 1980s, that just didn't exist, you know, at least not for learning in math and science.
But now that we have your course and we have Ali Abdaal and we have Thomas Frank and we have Karl Mamedic and we have like all these great YouTubers online explaining those things, and we have Benedict Carey, how we learn, and we have like many things. Basically, the education department is becoming less and less relevant. This is my, and it's not just about online courses. It's not online learning. It's not technology. Interleaving is not technology. Retrieval practice is not technology. Flashcard is not technology. Even if you mention Anki, there is something profoundly different, that the education, all the things that we learn in education, all the PhD conducted there, basically worthless. And what we achieve, like I go to Ali Abdaal, I go to Thomas Frank, I go to Barbara Oakley, I go to this great How We Learn, How We Think course in edX, which is what, and I have all the things right in front of me. Why do I need education institute? Why do I need the Department of Education? You don't have to answer this.
Well, you know, the problem is schools of education around, certainly in the US, are often just completely out of date. And the problem is that there's no incentive really to get up to date, because they can, you know, if you want to get a teaching license, I mean, you have to go through, and there's no really compelling need for them to like stop teaching learning styles, for example, or teaching other outmoded theories that really have nothing to do with the latest breakthroughs in learning. There's just no incentives for them. So I think the only incentives that can take place are if good online schools of pedagogy can become available that are competitive with and that compete with these sort of staid, old-fashioned approaches to education. Because right now, you're exactly right. A lot of schools of education are just really sadly outdated, and they're teaching things that really are not only not
for example, the research of John Dulunsky, who has had great meta research of all the study techniques the student utilize and which one is better and which one is not better, and like highlight is a bad technique, rereading is a bad technique, but retrieval practice, interleaving, active recall is great, are great techniques, and nonetheless you see students in those departments that highlights everything, and highlight only beneficial for the highlight producer. So it seems just like you said, we have the research and we have the population, but there is a huge gap. And the only people who tried to bridge these gaps are guys from the STEM. This is my theory. Now, moving forward from, again, this is a great book, but this was written in, just a second,
2014.
But now, lo and behold, when I go to Amazon, I have 2021, and Common Sense Teaching, Practical Insight in Brand Science to Help Students Learn, from Barbara Oakley, Terry Sinofsky, and Beth Rogowski. She must be Jewish. Okay, so my question is, what is new? What is new in this 2021 book that you didn't write in this book?
Oh,
what did you learn? What did you learn during the last 7 years?
Oh, so much that it would take a book, like Common Sense Teaching, to tell you. And so there's associated with it is a massive open online course. We've done the first one. It's called Uncommon Sense Teaching. And like the book, it's got spectacular ratings. And some of the comments say things like, you know, I've taken Learning How to Learn, I've read A Mind for Numbers, and this is completely, you know, it's a completely different perspective. It brings in all these new insights that weren't even discussed.
That you wrote here, would you consider incorrect right now?
No, not at all.
Okay.
In fact, sometimes I'm surprised at, you know, wow, it really is borne up. But what has changed is that now I understand the why better. For example, in A Mind for Numbers, I talk about sort of when you're learning to hit a baseball and you practice a lot of times so that you can do it without thinking about it and so forth. And that is relevant to learning to be quick when you're doing mathematical, you know, like multiplication or working with equations and so forth. I didn't understand why that was the case. It is true, but I didn't understand why. But now I understand why, and that's all explained in Uncommon Sense Teaching. It's
which is also has like this companion online course in Coursera.
Yes. Yeah. So the great thing about writing a book and pairing it with a course is that book is it's like a rock. You can look at it, you can analyze it, you can hold it, and you can think about things. With a course, a lot of the ideas are about things that are processes that are occurring in the brain. So you want to see how those processes are flowing and interacting with one another. And you can't do that with, you know, it's harder to see with a bunch of still pictures in a book. Whereas, you know, you can instantly see the relationship and how things are flowing. And it's, you know, and plus you can have lots more fun surprises. I didn't bring zombies in. Maybe I should be bringing zombies into too. But there's lots of really fun things.
I must ask you, because someone just cut your head there, yes? Or it is another
course. They did. They cut my head. Oh, yeah. It's when I was laughing about the fact that I was like, to my chemistry teacher in 11th grade, I was like, come on, Mr. Fry, see if you can put it in my brain, you know? And then they took my head and kind of flipped it
now,
open.
I must ask you some politic question, because it's like going from, Fox News to NBC. Now, you are like the Coursera talent. And did they approach to you from edX and say, listen, would you like the next course to be at edX platform? Or you are like the talent of Coursera?
Oh, well, edX did approach me to be a talent for edX. And they sang me sweet nothings. And I created a course for them called Learn Like a Pro.
So we have Learning Like a Pro, which is the blue book. Yes, the blue book,
yes.
Learning Like a Pro. We have Mindshift.
Yeah.
We have, okay, so MindShift and Learning How to Learn, both in Coursera. Learning Like a Pro is NX. And then we have, just a second, don't tell me, Uncommon Sense Teaching, which is on edX, on Coursera.
On Coursera.
And it is right, it is online right now, or you're just preparing it?
No, the first of three MOOCs is online right now. So, and I have to tell you, it's super good. If you even just go look at Uncommon Sense Teaching Coursera, look at the ratings. It's like,
so it's going to be like a nano degree, like I think that they call it specialization. So three courses.
Exactly right. Yes. Yeah. So there'll be three courses. The first one is out, and people are just loving it. And I love creating it. To me, it's like art form.
You know, one of the things that I mention all the time is the production value of Learning How to Learn, like the most viewed course, online course ever, was not Hollywood. Nevertheless, the content was so good that it didn't even matter. And when we think about like, okay, we need to add more animation and we need to have like 3D thing. Listen, Learning How to Learn was shot with a very simple green screen and zombie-like PowerPoint presentation. And it's one of the best courses ever. So don't get into too much all the accessories. Just give me the best stuff or the best materials that you could give me.
And I think what a lot of universities and professors do, they think that if they put a bunch of money into, you know, montages of the campus and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And that actually, it's just like a nothing burger. It doesn't add anything. And they don't use metaphors. They don't use moving visuals. They don't use humor. They don't use a little bit of surprise here and there. The thing is, if a school of education had done a course on learning, they would have done 2 weeks on the history of education, how babies learn, 2 more weeks on theories of learning, and then maybe a little tiny bit at the end on how you really learn. And we just flipped that, you know, we threw out everything that wasn't, you know, actually practically useful and wasn't based on sound neuroscience or cognitive psychology. And we used metaphors to take people into very in-depth concepts from neuroscience. And people can get them and they just love this. So, you know, it's when you can get yourself to look with a new framework at a very old and out of date field, people can really just fall in love with what you do.
Wow. Now, with your permission, two less questions, okay? Is it possible? Okay.
Yes.
So one thing that it means that I, a little bit like you, that I certainly hope that some of your books, including Evil Genes and Pathological Altruism and Color-Blooded Kindness, are not in the realm of complex system engineering. Like, you wrote a nonfiction book on subject much different from your daily job. And so do I. I wrote a book about intelligence, now artificial intelligence, about learning, about all the things. And I would like to hear from you, how do you approach this subject when you want to learn something new, okay, about altruism, about all the things? Because some of the books were published like in 2007 and 2008, and it way before Learning How to Learn came about. So first, how do you decide upon a subject? And when you decide, do you have like a procedure that you follow in learning those new things? Because this is a new topic, and a new topic is like a blue ocean. So what's your procedure when you're attacking a new topic?
This is a very interesting question. I decide because I just get curious about something. And usually I'm asking myself a question that seems very, very simple. But when you start to look at it, it's actually a question that kind of goes beyond usual disciplinary boundaries. So my first question that got me started in all of these kinds of things was, why do mean people do what they do? So not psychopaths, but people who are like your boss, who's super nice to you, but then takes credit for all of your work and then stabs you in the back. That kind of person. Why do they do that? That's not a question that's easily answered by looking within a discipline. And in fact, when I finally found a search term for the word or for that idea, which was malignant narcissism, I found that all the psychology literature just cited one another and had no scientific basis, zero, nothing, no citation whatsoever on any scientific search engine. So it was like psychology was just kind of doing this circular citation with no there. So anyway, what I try to do is I try to really go at the actual basic scientific literature, if there is some, and if there isn't, that tells me right away that that something funky is going on in that discipline. For me, when I was trying to get tenure as an engineering professor, I spent 6 years writing Evil Genes, Why Rome Fell, Hitler Rose, Enron Failed, and My Sister Stole My Mother's Boyfriend, and I kept it hidden carefully from anything. So my school
tenure community.
They never had any idea that I was doing anything outside of the ordinary, usual engineering stuff. But I tried, like when I started to write about pathologies of altruism, first I should start to try to learn everything I can about altruism. Well, I quickly found that that's kind of a complete waste of time, that I could spend years trying to understand all the research on altruism, but very little of it had any neuroscientific underpinning. And even what there was, as far as neuroscience, was questionable. So I just started kind of researching. And because I didn't know things, I did this edited book with my colleagues and asked people to write about pathologies of altruism in their field. And sometimes I got some really good stuff that helped teach me about it. And it was all very informative. And sometimes I just got regurgitated stuff that was of no interest to anybody. So sometimes I had to tell very major scientists that, sorry, their chapter has been rejected. So I guess it's always trying to use a solid research foundation, just going in and checking the direct literature, scientific literature myself, and then avoiding getting caught in the trap of lots of social science research that really isn't well grounded on science.
I think that what you said about everything that you said was important. One thing that looking for the right search term, and sometimes it will take you a lot to find the correct term that you need to check it up on Google Scholar or any other book. But when you find the term, you say, ah, wow, I found something. And it's like a journey. Every time it's a journey, and you start with like a notion of something that you want. And during my intelligence book, I just changed my mind a few times. Wow, this research is so different. Wow, it's a wonderful journey that I feel sorry for anyone who hasn't gone through this journey. It's a very emotional, it's an adventure journey. Professor Barbara Oakley, the one person from outside Israel who completely changed my life in the last 5 years. First of all, thank you so much for all the things that you do for education, for online learning, and for all the students who wants to excel at math, even if they flunk algebra. So first, thank you so much for your time.
Well, I can't tell you how much I appreciate it. This has actually been such a fun and fascinating conversation because you've really thought about a lot of the things I've wondered about. And your work on artificial intelligence and its relationship with human intelligence is really a fascinating area. So I salute you for your work on that. That's something I've just kind of gotten the edge on, a little bit with procedural learning, because our understanding of artificial intelligence and our understanding of the procedural learning system have informed each other, and they've grown hand in hand. So you're working in a really, really cool area. But it's just been a marvel today speaking with you.
Thank you so much. What is like your next biggest project after the current uncommon sense teaching? What is like the next biggest thing?
Oh, okay. So I'm working on this, and then I'll work on specialization related to learning for programming purposes. And then I am very excited about doing a book and probably a MOOC on critical thinking and the effects of the procedural system, which are unconscious, on our ability to think critically.
Wow. Looking forward to it. And now, right now, I'm going to sign myself to Uncommon Sense Teaching. Barbara Oakley, thank you so much for your time. This was great, great talk. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Roy.
אם הגעתם עד לכאן, מגיע לכם כל הכבוד. אז תנו לי להגיד לכם שלושה דברים קצרים. הדבר הראשון, אם שמעתם משהו בשיחה שמעניין אתכם, שאתם רוצים לקחת הלאה, פשוט ספרו אותו לאנשים אחרים. משהו מעניין שאני אמרתי, משהו מעניין שהאורח שלי אמר, איזשהו רעיון שאתם רוצים לקחת אתכם לחיים, פשוט ספרו אותו לחבר או לחברה. זאת הדרך הטובה ביותר לזכור את הרעיונות מתוך השיחות האלה. הדבר השני, אם אתם רוצים לקחת חלק בקהילה שלנו ולפגוש ולדבר עם אנשים כמוכם, אתם מוזמנים לערוץ הטלגרם שלנו, שווה לכם מאוד. פשוט תראו עוד אנשים שמתעניינים מדברים מגניבים בדיוק כמוכם. והדבר האחרון, אם אתם יכולים, דרגו את הערוץ שלנו באפליקציית הפודקאסטים שלכם, זה יכול להיות בספוטיפיי, באפל פודקאסט או בגוגל פודקאסט, זה תהליך קצר של שתי שניות, הוא מאוד מאוד יעזור לנו להפיץ את הבשורה הלאה. שיהיה לכם כיף גדול וכיף בשיחה הבאה.